Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm J.B. Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The wait is almost over. Get ready for the 2024 NFL season as the full schedule is announced. Bring it on. Every rivalry, every rematch, every rookie debut, every game revealed. The 2024 NFL schedule release, presented by Verizon, coming in May. Live on NFL Network, ESPN2, and streaming on NFL Plus. Terms and conditions apply to NFL Plus. Visit NFL.com/schedule release to learn more.
Welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hey, welcome to Stuff to Blow Your Mind. My name is Robert Lamb.
And I'm Christian Sager, and we have both been sick for like 2 weeks now, off and on. You and I have been alternating sicknesses.
Yeah. I at least two different illnesses have managed to wander their way through my household. My son is on his second illness this week, getting over something with a fever and a scratchy throat. I had it a couple of weeks ago, and even took it with me to Disney World, right before entering Disney World. I didn't actually enter the park with the illness.
And you went to Disney World the same time I went to Seattle, and I caught. I don't know if I got it from you or Jonathan Strickland, our colleague, had laryngitis last week, and he sits across from me. But sure enough, the day I got on the plane, I came down with something, and I had a horrible fever by the time I got to Seattle for my vacation and was just shivering. And luckily, I had 3 days. I ended up getting better before I attended Emerald City Comic Con last week. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I would have been patient zero at Emerald City and infected everybody. The nomenclature that's usually used at big conventions like that is con crud.
Oh, yes.
Because you're just bound to pick something up with that many people breathing on each other and touching each other. I know people who just have like hand sanitizer in their pockets at all time and are just constantly like rubbing their hands with it in their face. But you know what? Like, you're going to just get it no matter what.
Well, it's, you're combining several different things here. You have the convention where, like you say, a lot of people, tight space.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes physical interaction. And then on top of that, if you were flying there.
Oh, yeah.
Then you're in the airplane environment. So you're in this sealed tube with all of these coughing, hacking, breathing people. And it's just illnesses are going to be passed around. Like, I look back on the times when I've gotten sick with something, you know, notable, and I usually don't get that sick, but it generally follows international travel, or at least like a long, journey by plane.
This is no joke. Every single year I get sick one time, like a major way, and it's always when I go on a vacation. Mm-hmm. Always. It always happens. Last year I went to Portland, got sick the minute I got there, and it's either airplanes or maybe it's like I'm relaxing and I'm letting my immune system drop or something, but I'll say this, what you were just talking about with the coughing. Has anybody ever been on an airplane where somebody isn't hacking?
Yeah, it's like there's always going to be someone hacking. There's always going to be that crying child.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah,
it's just part of traveling.
But so we're circling around this, but our topic for today is actually the idea of a patient zero, of the first patient, the first victim bringing a disease to the human populace.
Yeah, or if not to the human populace as a whole, then at least to a center of population.
Yeah.
These are also known as index cases. That's really the more official title. The patient zero is the sexier sort of media word for this type of individual.
And it's really misleading.
Yes.
It's a misnomer and it's misleading. We're going to talk about why.
Yeah. And in order to discuss why, I think it's important that we also isolate some of the mythic and fictional variations of this trope.
Sure.
Because we're talking about the idea here that some illness or some flaw in character, and these two are often intermingled in myth, can be traced back to a single individual. And then how are we supposed to feel about that single individual?
Right. And being humans and doing what we do, we usually look upon them with disdain and write a narrative in which they are somehow the bad guy.
Right.
For getting us all sick.
And we, you know, we've talked about mythology on this podcast a lot in the past and about how powerful these mythological ideas are, even if we're not consciously invoking them. So I thought it might be a good idea to just look at some of these mythic examples and see how they are reflected in our modern view of the patient zero.
Okay.
So let's start with what we can think of as, like original sinners or OG sinners. one of the most famous is, of course, Pandora. Pandora is the first woman created by the gods. She opens a jar or a box, depending on your reading. And in doing this, she unleashes all the sort of nonspecific evils of the world. So thanks a lot, Pandora. Now we have evil in the world.
Yeah, and it's very easy to see that as a gendered narrative.
Oh, certainly.
Right? Our friends who used to do Stuff Mom Never Told You probably have an episode on a Pandora somewhere about the myth of that it's all Pandora's fault or it's all Eve's fault, right?
Yeah, Eve is the other big one, right?
Yeah.
Eve, the first woman as encountered in the Old Testament, she makes the mistake of listening to a talking snake. It was, of course, Satan, who convinces her to disobey the creator God and eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Mm. And this transgression leads to their expulsion from the earthly paradise, our mortal legacy of having to work and wear clothes and experience painful childbirth. So, again, a very gendered blame game going on here. This one primordial woman made a mistake, erred in judgment, listened to a talking snake, which is really a bit unfair, right? Because I've always looked back on that story and it's like, why is there a talking snake? You really threw a curveball here. Well, a talking snake.
I think, didn't all animals talk? I don't know my Bible that well. Joe should be here. But, I'm pretty sure that in the Garden of Eden, all animals talked. But maybe, here's what I've always
wondered. I don't remember
but
maybe that's from the Disney version.
That's where I was going, was I was thinking like, is the talking snake the same snake from the Jungle Book, is it like an ancient relative?
Ka? Yeah.
Yeah, Ka, exactly.
Oh, yeah. Maybe
Man
so.
Cub.
but certainly, yeah, Pandora, Eve, these are both examples of essentially a patient zero for human suffering.
Yeah.
Another big one from the Old Testament is, of course, Cain. He's the firstborn son, and his crime is a bit more complicated because you get into this issue of his sacrifice versus Abel's sacrifice, Abel being his brother. But however you want to attribute it, he's remembered as being the first murderer of his brother Abel. So God punished Cain to a life of wandering and set a mark on him so that no man would kill him.
Yeah, that is actually a bit of mythos that is popping up in a lot of popular culture fiction lately, the mark of Cain and the idea of bearing that mark of the first murderer. It's a little different than disease, but I think that in Cain's case, it's definitely one of those, like, this is why humanity is so burdened, right?
Yeah, and all three of these are examples, too, where the idea that the stain never washes away, right? Humans are always going to be stained with original sin, and or females are always going to have some degree of blame, right? Or in the case of Cain, it's carried on through Cain's children.
Yeah.
it indeed liken it as if it's an infectious agent.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, we also have plenty of examples of monster patriarchs and matriarchs. We have Echidna, the Greek from Greek myth. So this is the mate of the giant Typhon, and she gave birth to such monsters as Cerberus, the Hydra, the Chimera, the Sphinx, the Gorgon, Scylla, etc.
I have just been reading Chuck Wendig's book Zeros, mm-hmm. and it's not at all about mythology, but it is about cyberculture and artificial intelligence, and they heavily play off of the Echidna Typhon mythology within the sort of classifications of AI.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
There's also Lilith, the first wife of Adam, according to Jewish mythology, and you see later treatments, especially in fiction and vampire fiction, mm-hmm. Where Lilith is held up as this demon or the first vampire. And to draw in a less mythic and certainly more pop cultural example, I was always a big fan of Blade 2.
Blade 2 is a fantastic
Guillermo del Toro movie. Yeah. And that has a wonderful Patient Zero plot in it.
Yes, it does. Yeah.
The whole plot line here is there's a Patient Zero for a new strain of vampirism.
Right.
One that turns the vamps into reapers who feed on the blood of vampires. And so you have this character, Jared Nomak, who's the sort of tragic supervillain of the film.
Yeah. And that's an interesting take on it because like you can look at vampirism mythology in general as being about disease. Right. Mm-hmm. But then this sort of flips it on its head. It's a disease for the disease carriers.
And a situation where the disease changes. There's
right.
something is tweaked in the illness and suddenly it becomes all the more dangerous.
And that kind of mutation is actually very real and part of what we're going to talk about today with these ideas of patient zeros in major epidemic breakouts.
Yeah. Now, what are a few more here? Well, we've recently been talking about The Expanse.
Ah, yeah.
And there's the character Juliette Mao on that show who's infected with the proto-molecule, and that becomes a major plot point in the first book and the first couple of seasons of the show.
Yeah.
In Stephen King's The Stand, some of you King fans out there might remember that there's one individual, Charles Campion, I believe.
Is he the security guard who, like, ends up like leaving the base when he's not supposed to?
Yeah, I believe like so. Yeah. He becomes the patient zero for Captain Tripp's super flu.
The stand is truly like the epidemic story of our time. I anytime I get a really bad flu, I refer to it as Captain Tripp's. Yeah, and there's this movie that came out maybe 2 or 3 years ago that I thought of. It's called Contracted. They've made a sequel to it as well. It's a zombie movie technically, but it's about the whole thing is about a woman who contracts zombieism, I guess, mm-hmm. as a sexually transmitted disease from a patient zero. And it's a slow burn of her basically like going through the initial stages of the disease, the movie ending with her turning into a zombie. But apparently Contracted 2, which I have not seen, is about finding the patient zero.
Ah, now this is kind of a familiar trope to some of these films, such as The Ring.
Yeah,
and potentially even It Follows. Like I've understood that if they do a follow-up film, that's going to be what it deals with, is kind of
right.
finding the agent, I mean the patient zero.
There is sort of an element of that in the original It Follows, mm-hmm. if they ever come out with a sequel. I kind of hope
they leave it where it is.
But yeah, the idea that they need to find out whoever the first person is who's contracted this curse. Yeah.
Because that's our human tendency, right?
Yeah.
We want to find out where did it begin? Who can we blame? And it becomes this complicated game that is both that has certainly elements of important science to it, in terms of containing and figuring out how the illness works, but also draws in all of these less scientific mythic ideas.
So let's unravel this a little bit. What is exactly a patient zero or an index case?
So, as we've been discussing it, we're essentially talking about the first known patient to exhibit symptoms of a given illness. It's one that plays out into so many of our dramas about infectious disease. Some of the examples we didn't touch on that have been mentioned in some of our sources are Contagion, that came out in 2011, 12 Monkeys, 95, and 28 Days Later, came out in 2002.
and Outbreak was in a lot of my notes.
Oh, yeah.
But as Robert mentioned earlier, scientists prefer the term index case. The reason why is identifying a single person as the patient zero both gives an incorrect impression about how a disease might emerge, and it insinuates that somebody should be blamed for the outbreak, right? At the same time, it's important to find out what's going on with these cases, because then if you know their history, you can help researchers determine how and when the outbreak started. So some refer to this as detective work, or I actually saw it referred to as shoe leather epidemiology in one of the articles. So basically the idea here is you backtrack the disease, and once patient zero is identified, you try to figure out how they got sick. So were they in contact with a certain species of animal, or what kind of activities did they do right before they got sick, or how exposed were they? Like, did they have open wounds, or did they breathe something in? Did they ingest something, or was it just something in the air? So what today's research is really going to ask us to consider is that this is a state of harnessing scientific authority to enact coercive measures while drawing upon contemporary beliefs that either race or class or sexuality could lend to this patient zero's propensity for disease. Because when patient zero is defined as someone with distinguishing traits, whether that's behavior or sexuality or race, it makes it easier for those of us with different characteristics to reassure ourselves that we're not at risk. This doesn't have to do with us, mm-hmm. right? And they typically locate disease origins as being in, quote, pre-modern parts of the world. So there's a concern that this narrative deflects attention away from the structural factors that can affect transmission and health outcomes. It's also incredibly difficult to nail down a patient zero.
Yeah. It's one of these ideas that certainly works better in fiction than it does in reality.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems, like 28 days later, it's really easy to say like, oh, the monkey bit this person and then this person spread it. You know what I mean? It's very easy to do it that way. That's not how the real world works.
Right. I mean, it's irresistible from a fictional standpoint because it invokes those myths. But actually finding that individual there, we're going to discuss some cases of alleged patient zeros, but for the most part, it's a rather difficult exercise.
Yeah, because the thing here is that infectious agents can percolate in the environment for years, sometimes even decades, without being detected. And when they do enter the human population, it could be through more than just one person. Also, some people are more capable of spreading disease than others. So one argument is basically, well, instead of thinking of it in terms of patient zeros, maybe we should be thinking of super spreaders. And there's also a terminology for people who are referred to as super shedders as well. Hmm. And these are the people who shed many more types of the virus into an environment.
Okay.
So we've got a lot to unpack here. I think we're going to see more of it when we look at the examples.
Now, you might well ask yourself, well, how does one become the first carrier of a particular illness? Well, the answer here, of course, is that they mutate. They leap from a non-human host to a human when they adapt and sustain. So for many zoonotic infectious diseases, the first step involves the species jump. All right. We've seen this. You've seen this in a number of examples that have popped up in the news over the years. You know, bird flu, swine flu.
Yep.
The idea that these are strains of influenza that have thus far been isolated to a non-human animal, but through close proximity, this thing is able to jump to us and then sustain itself in this new host.
Yeah, and we're going to see in some of these examples that bats are actually a huge factor mm-hmm. in zoonotic infections. The other thing that I was going to mention, too, is this reminds me of our episode on the guinea worm, where it was other way around, and that the guinea worm jumped to dogs from humans.
Yeah, we thought we had it wiped out, and then we found out it had jumped to dogs as a new hiding place, thus complicating our efforts to eradicate it. So anyway, they get into a human, they can spread through the human population. And to put that in perspective, about 60% of all existing human infectious diseases are zoonotic. So it's not a case where, oh, this is a strange situation where this illness jumped from one species to another. This seems to largely be how they work. Like this is a common factor in studying, preventing, and fighting infectious disease.
So why is it important for science to be able to attribute a patient zero?
Well, there are two main factors here, of course. One is the chance to better contain the outbreak. If you can pinpoint who brought it, then you can follow the chain. You can try and contain it. You can do everything you can to prevent the further spread of the illness. And then secondly, it's the chance to determine where and when the outbreak started based on the patient's personal history. It gets one step closer to the source, you
right.
know?
Yeah.
Cause essentially you're condensing the history of the illness to the history of the person, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that can conceivably be easier to track down. Now, an example of this in action would be when medical professionals traced the 2014 West African outbreak of Ebola back to a 2-year-old child who died on December 6, 2013. By January 1st of 2014, the child's mother, 3-year-old sister, and grandmother had died as well. So this was a town in Guyana, which sits adjacent to the borders of Liberia and Sierra Leone. So there's easy access for it to spread into different regions, which explains how it managed to spread through three countries within a matter of months. Isolating the patient zero in this case allowed researchers to map the transmission of the virus and better understand how and where it was spreading. But as we'll explore, this helpful concept can also spin out of control thanks to the complications of human prejudice
right.
and just the power of this mythic idea that there's a single individual to blame
yeah.
for something as complex as the mutation and spread of an infectious disease.
In fact, I believe in that particular Ebola case, I believe that there were some factors of witchcraft being blamed.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important to see, you know, patient zero not only works in a medical situation and that like we need to apply it so that we can try to contain the outbreak, figure out what its origins are, but it also works from the human cultural perspective of trying to understand what's going on, right?
Right.
Why don't we take a quick break? And when we get back, we're going to take a look at some patient zeros of note throughout history.
Shout out to Astapro for sponsoring this episode and providing us with free samples.
Rob, as the local host with allergies here, they sent you some of their nasal spray to treat your allergies. What was your experience like?
Yeah, that's right. I always wrestle with the pollen a bit when it rolls in during the spring. So they sent me the little nasal spray. I tried out the product and yeah, it sure did help me get on top of my symptoms for the day. And it's so fast acting, it was already kicking in before I left the house.
Astapro is a first-of-its-kind nasal allergy spray. It's the fastest 24-hour over-the-counter allergy spray. It starts working in 30 minutes, while other allergy sprays take hours. Astapro is the first and only 24-hour steroid-free allergy spray. Astapro delivers full prescription-strength indoor and outdoor allergy relief from nasal congestion, runny and itchy nose, and sneezing.
Get fast-acting nasal allergy symptom relief with Astapro. Go to astaproallergy.com for a discount so you can get Astapro and go today. Astaproallergy.com. Astapro and go. Use as directed for relief of nasal congestion, runny nose, sneezing, and itchy nose due to allergies.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, we're back. So, yeah, we're going to talk about some patient zeros here. And this first one I'm particularly fond of because the story actually comes up in the first season of The Nick, which was is a fabulous Cinemax TV series starring Clive Owen about the rapid advances in the medical profession in the early 20th century.
And it's a really rough story for this particular individual. I'm sure most of you have been thinking about her as we've been talking about Patient Zero. Of course, we mean Typhoid Mary.
Yeah, the name itself has become synonymous with someone who unknowingly spreads a disease.
Yeah, and so Typhoid Mary was actually a woman named Mary Malone or Malin. She was an Irish immigrant, and she was forcibly quarantined after officials determined that she was spreading disease to unsuspecting families that she worked for as a cook. Now, the idea here was basically that she worked in these homes, and members of the homes, they would develop typhoid fever. They would get it from Salmonella typhi. So they quarantined her on two occasions for a total of 26 years. And she subsequently even sued the New York Department of Health because she was basically imprisoned, but she was unsuccessful. Is that what they cover in The Nick? Do they talk about her quarantining?
The quarantine's kind of set up at the end. It basically, there's a character in the show who inspects outbreaks and tries to get to the bottom of it. And there's a strong, immigrant, aspect of the plot as well. But you have a couple of the characters who are investigating this outbreak and trying to determine what's causing it.
Yeah. So, I mean, we can see here, not only was she a woman and it made it gendered, but she was also Irish. And at the time, there was a lot of prejudice against Irish immigrants. So, of course, it worked very well for them to say, well, this is the person who this whole thing broke out with. It's her that's responsible for this. She's actually not technically what we would refer to as a patient zero, though.
Yeah, I guess she might qualify as a super shedder, perhaps?
Either a super spreader or a super shredder.
Okay.
That sounds like some kind of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles.
Well, yeah, there was Super Shredder in the second one.
I believe it's that they're shredding the virus.
And he did mutate.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So.
But her case, it's actually similar to that movie 28 Weeks Later. Mm-hmm. So the idea here is it's somebody who can spread the disease, but they're also immune to it. So she didn't get sick herself, but she was supposedly spreading it to all these other people.
Yeah, she was an asymptomatic carrier, which means that she carried the disease, she transmitted it, but she exhibited no symptoms herself. And that's what made her inadvertently so dangerous.
Yeah.
Because she didn't seem like a sick person, but she was carrying this deadly infection.
And it made it very easy for them to basically lock her up for half of her life.
Yeah.
I think she died in prison, actually.
Yeah. It's interesting that we bring this up, of course, on the week of St. Patrick's Day, because I think for a lot of modern listeners, it's especially given, you know, the importance of people of Irish descent in our country and you know, the celebration of St. Patrick's Day and et cetera. It's easy to forget that Irish immigrants had kind of a second class citizen classification, mm-hmm. In these times, not too long ago.
Not very long ago at all. Yeah.
And of course, another case is with Chinese Americans. And we have an example of that comes up. This was from a similar time period. This was back in 1900. Public health officials discovered the corpse of a 41-year-old Chinese man named Wing Chongqing in the basement of the Globe Hotel. So this was in San Francisco. And signs pointed to bubonic plague. And indeed, this was the start of the San Francisco plague of that was an issue from 1900 to 1904. So if officials responded to this by ordering a complete quarantine of Chinatown. They ordered all white residents to evacuate and had mandatory house-by-house fumigation and vaccination for all of the residents. So it's another case in which, yes, on one level, there's a rational attempt here to contain the spread of an infectious disease, but there's also this element of race and social standing that's playing into it. You know, the idea, well, let's get all the white people out and let's deal with the problem here, which are the Chinese people, and just how ridiculous and ultimately grotesque that notion is, and potentially ineffective in containing the illness.
Yeah, you see how in these American examples, and we're going to talk about HIV a lot later, that their immigration scares, essentially, right? Mm-hmm. And in the case of HIV, it's a scare of sexuality. But I mean, I could very easily see, given our current situation with immigration here in the United States, that it would be very easy to latch onto a narrative that somebody who is either Latino or Middle Eastern was a patient zero of some kind in the coming years, right? That would be a very similar storyline to what we saw with Typhoid Mary and Wing Chongqing, basically like demonizing them so that the predominant narrative is, oh, it's not me. I'm okay. I'll be fine as long as I stay away from those people.
Right. I mean, well, you see, there's been a lot of discussion in the media recently about the idea that we see the exact same thing with acts of violence and terrorism, mm-hmm. right? That the idea is that we end up focusing on individuals who are othered in some respect. So it's individuals from a predominantly Muslim nation or a nation that has some connection to these cases of violent extremism, and then saying, well, this is where it's coming from. And then you're dismissing other fonts of violence, other fonts of terrorism that occur domestically or in other nations that for various reasons are not receiving the same level of scrutiny.
Right. But it happens in other nations too. It's mm-hmm. not just the United States, right?
Oh, certainly. This is a human-wide phenomenon. So another example of a patient zero here, or an alleged patient zero, was a Chinese doctor by the name of Dr. Liu Jianlun. This is he's a 64-year-old. He was from Guangdong province. This is home to Guangzhou, for anyone who's trying to piece it together on a map. And he spent the night in a Hong Kong hotel. And according to a report from CNN, he may have transferred his virus to at least 16 other guests staying on the same floor, that virus being SARS.
Yeah. So the idea here, this definitely seems to be a case of what they call super spreading. Mm-hmm. It's thought that Liu acquired the disease from a hospital that he worked in. So a farmer in Guangdong first developed SARS after coming into contact with an animal. So we've talked about this already. This is zoonotic infectious disease that jumps from one species to another. So it's believed that SARS originated in bats, actually, and then spread to other animals like civet cats before infecting humans. And so when the genetic material from two or more other viruses infect a single human or really any animal, the host itself is referred to as a reassortment event, right? And so that is what is assumed to have happened here. A lot of deadly diseases are linked to bats in this way, and we'll give you some more examples later, but Ebola, hepatitis C, SARS, and perhaps MERS are all linked to bats. In the case of SARS, it's thought that it first spread to humans actually in 1994 by bats that were infecting horses in Brisbane, Australia. Then two people caught the virus from the horses, and they think it was possibly from scratches that were exposed to infected horse blood. Both of these people died horrible deaths. In other diseases, pigs have become infected by eating saliva-covered fruit that's dropped by bats, and then that subsequently infects the humans who eat the pigs. People can also be directly infected by drinking juice from date palms that have been contaminated by bats.
It's interesting you bring bats up because, you know, in talking about Typhoid Mary, we talked about how she was an asymptomatic carrier.
Yeah.
And of course, bats are asymptomatic carriers of rabies.
Yeah.
They don't display the rabies of, you know, they're not foaming at the mouth, but they can be carriers of it. And that's why, as everyone I think has heard, if you're bitten by a bat, you have to act accordingly, as if you've contracted rabies.
Yeah, it's a different episode for another time, but mm-hmm. I would love for us to tackle bats and their immune systems and just their anatomy in general. We did a How Stuff Works video, man, it was like 3 years ago, where we went to Dragon Con and we interviewed a woman who was a specialist in bats mm-hmm. and viral spreading. And it was just really interesting. Huh. The idea basically being that they have these crazy fast metabolisms that just process things right out of them. But on the other hand, they're also super susceptible to spreading these diseases. The other thing is that in the case of SARS, it's thought that a few wild civets were infected by bats, and then these civets were caught and taken to the market, and the virus jumped to humans.
Huh.
You know what I immediately think of here? Have you heard about this coffee that's made from civet poop?
Oh, yeah. I have never had it, but I'm familiar with it.
But so if nobody out there has heard of this, apparently, I think in LA, it's kind of a thing. You can buy like a cup of coffee that costs like what? It's like $80 or something crazy like that for one cup of coffee. It's supposed to be like the best coffee in the world. So the idea here, I think, is that, these civets eat coffee beans, they digest them, and then when it comes out the other end, they're able to somehow process it into coffee, not the civets, people.
Uh-huh. it's not coffee itself. Just pouring directly out of their
right, exactly.
Bones,
they process it, and it supposedly has like this amazing fruity flavor.
Hmm.
But my first thought was, well, what if these civets are bitten by bats, and you're drinking this $80 coffee? Do you then get SARS from your coffee?
Yeah, I can imagine the cell being, look, this is going to be the best cup of coffee you ever have. You're going to catch SARS probably, but just give it a try.
I mean,
it's so good.
I doubt that's the case. Otherwise, people would probably be warned about this super expensive coffee. But still, it just kind of made me think about that whole thing.
Now, Dr. Liu Jianlun here, he wouldn't have been patient zero per se, but it was still a critical factor in the spread of the disease because people from that hotel traveled, and in less than 4 months, about 4,000 cases and 550 deaths from SARS could be traced back to his stay in Hong Kong. And this just makes me think back to our stories about traveling.
Yeah.
While sick, like when we have these tales of patient zeros or alleged patient zeros, it's really easy to apply blame and say, oh, that was so irresponsible of that person to travel while they were sick
right.
and got all these other people sick. And yet this is something we all do. We all know that if you're sick, you should probably not travel. We know that if your kid's sick, you shouldn't send them to school. And yet this happens all the time because we make our plans, we spend money, we have our jobs to do, we have our lives to, all planned out. And then illnesses come along and we generally just try and plow through it if we possibly can.
Exactly. I mean, like, so in both of our cases, you and I had both invested a lot of money mm-hmm. in going on these vacations. It's not like you're just going to, You can't just cancel
right.
those plans because that's a huge, you know, wash essentially. Now, yeah, you know, some of you out there are probably saying, well, you should have for the betterment of mankind, for everybody around you. I mean, for my part, like I think try to wear one of those masks or something.
Mm-hmm.
Or honestly, after this last week, I would recommend that everybody just wear one of those masks when you're on a plane from now on. Those first really got popularized with SARS, right? I remember that.
Yeah. I mean, of course, in much of Asia, you still see them all the time in any kind of like a public gathering, yeah. a sporting event.
Much so that they're like, they've kind of like, gotten some like aesthetic designs to them, right? Like,
yeah. With, yeah.
Like,
you do see some
logos and
ones.
Stuff emblazoned on them. Yeah. But, you know, I think that's probably the smart way to go. I remember seeing people like that on the train or whatever and being like, oh, what a germaphobe. And now I'm like, yeah, it makes sense. Like yeah, they're
germaphobe,
actually thinking
but maybe
ahead.
They're a germaphobe that's not sick right
yeah,
now.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Okay. Here's a couple other examples. So, there was a 6-year-old and I don't think this is his real name, but he was referred to as Captain Boonmanuk. And he was a Thai boy who was the first confirmed casualty of avian influenza, or as we more commonly call it, bird flu. In 2004, he fell ill and his family reported that he had recently scooped up a chicken and that chicken was thought to have had the virus. So he's referred to as the patient zero for that. We've also got Edgar Hernandez, who is a 5-year-old living in the Mexican town of La Gloria, when doctors identified him as the earliest documented case of swine flu in 2009. There you go with a recent example of somebody of Latino descent who's mm-hmm. blamed as a patient zero. But yeah, he was called the earliest documented case of swine flu. They believe this came from, again, a reassortment event. The idea here was that the H1N1 strain was mixed inside pigs and that created new combinations that were more likely to infect people. Edgar Hernandez was the first one that they documented.
Now for this next one, this is the individual that, we referenced already when we were talking about that Ebola case, that 2-year-old. But you have some additional information here.
Yeah, so it looks like, and I'm probably butchering this name, but the name is Emil Umuno. And like Robert had earlier said, it was a toddler living in the village of Milandu when he developed Ebola. So Robert mentioned how quickly that spread and that basically it was because the town that this happened in, it was on the intersection of 3 different countries. So the virus spread really easily. This showed researchers just how transmissible Ebola can be and that specifically dealing with the sick is a high risk event for acquiring the infection. Now, in this case, they were saying like, look, whether or not it's like a medicine man type figure, a shaman type figure, or even if it's just some kind of a medical doctor, that they're basically putting themselves into these high risk scenarios where mm-hmm. they can then subsequently become super spreaders. In addition to the detective work that the researchers did, they were also able to sequence the genomes of 99 Ebola viruses that were found in samples taken from 78 patients in Sierra Leone. This led them to believe that the virus was brought to West Africa in the past decade by an animal. And so, like we said earlier, you know, this could have been bats. It's also thought Ebola can be transmitted through monkeys and forest antelope as well. And we've also got a patient here who is a 68-year-old South Korean man. He's thought to be the so-called patient zero for MERS or Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. He was an extensive traveler and he had been in Bahrain, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Qatar before returning to South Korea. Now, MERS can take 2 to 14 days before symptoms begin to show. Mm-hmm. So it's thought that he may have transmitted it to 28 other people before he even arrived at a hospital.
That's an important note to make because even if you're not a purely asymptomatic carrier of a disease, so many different diseases and illnesses have an asymptomatic period. This is the case in a number of STDs as well,
right.
Where one is carrying the STD, but you're not displaying lesions or, you know, or swelling or rashes or whatever the symptoms are of like a full-blown outbreak.
Yeah. And so speaking of STDs, now we've got the big term for patient zero. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the redemption of the man who was first designated patient zero or the first man supposedly to have HIV.
Today's episode is brought to you by Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast. When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast from Ruby Studio in partnership with Intel. Explore the future of technology that's rapidly evolving our world today with the help of AI. There's still so much work and research needed to fully understand the power and potential of AI, and Intel is at the forefront of implementing AI in revolutionary technology that's changing the world we live in for the better. In each episode, Graham interviews the minds transforming medicine and healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more while pioneering new uses for AI in these spaces. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. If you haven't heard of Visible, now you have. They're the wireless carrier that's making wireless visible. It's in the name. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. Having a one-line plan means you only need you to save. No estranged roommates, exes, cousins twice removed, or AI-powered humanoid robots needed. And because $25 a month really means $25 a month, you can call, text, stream, whatever, as much as you want without worrying about getting dinged at the end of the month.
No hidden fees, no surprises. No, really. It's like the old saying goes, you can't judge a book by its cover, but you can judge a company by its name. So spread the word. Tell all your friends there's a wireless company out there with transparency in their name, and they're called Visible. Start saving on wireless today at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan for data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend? Or do something a little more epic and conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Today's episode is brought to you by eBay. eBay Motors is here for the ride. Remember when you first saw the potential? And then, through some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles in a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Look to your left. Look to your right. It's official. No one's got a ride like this. There's nothing else that sounds like, feels like, or looks like the set of wheels in your garage. With over 122 million parts, you can make sure your number one ride or die stays running smoothly, so there's no limit to how far you can take it. Brake kits, turbochargers, engines, exhaust kits, roof racks, LED headlights, bumpers, whatever your baby needs, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, well, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
All right, we're back. So we're talking here about Gaetan Dugas.
Yeah, he is often attributed as being the patient zero for the HIV crisis. He was a Canadian flight attendant that was accused of introducing the virus to North America after he picked it up in either Haiti or Europe. And Dugas was said to have infected hundreds of sexual partners before his death in 1984. Now, this is where the term patient zero was popularized. This shocked me. I thought that term had been around for a very long time, at least as far back as Typhoid Mary. But it turns out it's relatively recent within our lifetimes.
Yeah. I mean, this was a major publication. They did a TV movie based on it that, that had Matthew Modine.
Starring, Stuff to Blow Your Mind favorite, Matthew Modine. He played the doctor, I believe, not Dugas.
Different doctor from the one he plays in Stranger Things.
Well, who knows? Yeah. But yeah, so this, the term was popularized in a book that was by a guy named Randy Schiltz. And this book is called And the Band Played On. It came out in 1987, and it documented the early years of the AIDS crisis. Schiltz took the medical term patient O, that's the letter O, and turned it into zero in the book, describing Dugas as a person who continually had sex with partners without regard for their health, even after his physicians told him to stop. The book also says that Dugas would purposely show partners his sarcoma lesions after sex and say things like, I've got gay cancer, I'm going to die, and so are you. Now, the reason why the letter O was misinterpreted as a zero, this turned into the provocative term patient zero. It actually meant O for outside of California. And the book, as we said, was made into a film.
Now, one thing to keep in mind about Randy Schiltz here, and I bring this up because not everyone's probably may not be that familiar with the book and what his background is, especially when we're talking so much about othering here and discussing the outsider as the source of an illness. Now, Schiltz himself was a homosexual man, and he also eventually died of HIV, though he held off on finding out for sure if he had the illness until he had completed the book, because he didn't want it to color his prose. Again, he was a acclaimed journalist in his life, like prior to writing the book. So I want everyone to have the proper impression of him before we keep going.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, so what we're going to discover here is that, well, Schiltz was wrong about Dugas, but that doesn't mean that Schiltz necessarily was a bad person.
Right. Now, in terms of Dugas, we talk a bit about the redemption of him as a carrier of the illness. He still allegedly boasted of 250 partners a year after he learned of his condition.
Right.
He was highly vilified, certainly following this book coming out. Many Canadians apparently saw it as a shame on the nation. You know, the idea that here's this guy who played such a pivotal role in spreading this disease, and he was one of us. He was Canadian. And how are we supposed to feel about that?
Right.
And still, as sensational as all of this was at the time, and as vilified as he was following The Band Played On, not everyone at the time was really into the sensation. When the book came out in the late 80s, pioneering AIDS researcher Professor Marcus Conant of the University of California at San Francisco told Time magazine, quote, "If it hadn't been this man, it would have been some other." So, yeah. You know, as much... even though one is, you know, instantly inclined to say, oh, this guy's patient zero. Look how reckless he was. Look how terrible he was. He should have cared more for his fellow humans. If it hadn't have been him, it would have been someone else. Like when you're dealing with an infectious disease, it's not a thing that is born out of human choice. It's not something as simple as Pandora opening that box.
Yeah.
And even then you could say, well, if Pandora didn't open it, someone would have opened it. You have a box sitting around. You can't just leave a box with a lid on it and expect that nobody's ever going to try it out and see what's inside.
Yeah. And as we're going to find out, you know, not only would it have been somebody else if it wasn't Dugas, but it was already out there. It was already in the world. It was already in the human populace. It just wasn't in the United States yet. And that's the thing here too, right? Is that like the narrative is, oh, this is the guy who brought it to the United States. But we didn't care about the people who were infected with this in the Caribbean or in Africa.
Yeah, so the idea that that everyone in the U.S. was somehow, you know, situated in this just on another planet, essentially,
and
was completely removed from the threats of it via this station in the world. Like one example that comes to mind when discussing all this is another case of destructive introduction of an infectious disease, and that's Spanish explorers bringing smallpox, influenza, and measles into the New World.
Sure.
Now, this, of course, played a huge role in, you really can't overestimate the role this played. It gave them the ability to exert military dominance, certainly with more ease. It was just a vital factor in this population coming in to the new world. And you can easily ask, well, what if this hadn't have happened? What if they hadn't introduced these illnesses? Well, it's hard to envision a situation where it wouldn't have, right? I mean, because people were traveling across the world. The world was getting smaller. These were some of the, you know, the first contact between these two human populations. It was going to happen.
Yeah.
Now you can say, well, maybe it would. There are scenarios where you can imagine it happening in a way that wasn't so destructive. But these illnesses were going to spread into the new world. There's really no way to imagine an alternative scenario. I mean, unless there was some sort of a, you know, Star Trek Prime Directive scenario involved here.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I don't think, that early colonists had any Prime Directives in mind. What this makes me think of is just from my, you know, local history growing up, in New England. So Amherst, Massachusetts is a town that my family is just generally mm-hmm. from around that area. My mother lives there. It's named after Lord Geoffrey Amherst. What a lot of people don't know, even who live in the town, is that Lord Geoffrey Amherst purposely gave smallpox blankets to the Native American population in the area, you know, subsequently killing a lot of people. Yet, you know, this is one of the larger towns in New England. It's also sort of a celebrated bastion of liberalism today, mm-hmm. which is ironic.
And yet here's this figure who is essentially engaging in biological warfare uh-huh. via these infected blankets.
Now, in the case of Dugas, there was a recent article in Nature that found that HIV, in fact, entered the U.S. several years before he even did. They determined this through a genetic analysis of stored blood samples. And what they found was that the virus entered the U.S. from the Caribbean somewhere around 1971. And they think it was possibly through contaminated blood products like blood plasma. It wasn't even human to human interaction. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this was, of course, a big deal in a lot of the early HIV transmissions. If you're any science fiction fan, so they'll probably remember that Isaac Asimov contracted HIV this way.
He did not know that, really.
He had some heart surgery, I believe.
Okay.
And he ended up contracting HIV from the transfusion. But it was so scandalous at the time. It was, I think, 10 years after his death before that fact was made public by his family, where they said, yeah, this is what happened.
Same thing happened in my family. My grandfather contracted HIV through heart surgery. But this is interesting. I've never heard about this about Isaac Asimov. But yeah, same thing. My grandfather was a doctor and he contracted HIV when he had heart surgery. And of course, because he was a doctor, he didn't want to lash out at the medical community or the hospital where he was treated at. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was just something that we dealt with.
Yeah.
Now in the case of figuring out what went on with Dugas, what's really interesting here is they used similar techniques to those that are used to decipher the badly degraded ancient DNA from fossils.
Huh.
So what they did was they found that the viral DNA was so genetically diverse that the viruses must have been circulating in cities for years prior to 1978, which is how they picked up all these variations. So the researchers believe that HIV first jumped to the United States from Haiti somewhere around 1970 or 1971. The samples that they looked at all came from the same family tree of HIV, and these were all the same as the one from the Caribbean. So that suggests that the HIV virus spread from Africa to the Caribbean and then to the United States. But then again, because of some specific markers, they think New York was where it specifically went to from the Caribbean somehow through these blood plasma products.
You know, it's interesting here because we've discussed the idea that these are things that emerge from less civilized places. They emerge in the wild, right, in rural areas. But yet at the same time, large centers of population, including places like New York, you know, certainly one of the more famous metropolitan areas in the world, like a modern city if there ever was one. Like these are classic incubation sites for illnesses and disease. When you look back at the history of infectious disease for human beings, like this is that we see this time and time again. People come together, they create these cities, and certainly cities are great for enterprise, for economics, for cultural ideas, but they are also places where diseases pick up steam.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I love New York. It's one of my favorite places in the world to be. But anytime I get on the subway and in New York, I'm just like, it's almost like I get this like special vision where all I'm seeing is just like creepy crawly potential viruses or bacteria just on everything, you know? And you just have to go with it, right?
Yeah.
And of course that's why New York works so well in like apocalyptic disease fiction, like The Stand, right? Like, mm-hmm. you remember there's that scene in The Stand where, the Lincoln Tunnel, I believe it is like all completely backed up because everybody just died in their cars. And one of the characters has to like crawl through the Lincoln Tunnel in the pitch black dark, surrounded by all these diseased corpses. And it's, of course, New York makes sense for that setting.
All right. So we've been dancing around this, but yeah, we really come back to this idea is that why are we so drawn to this idea of patient zero? Why is this trope? Why is this mythic, description, so irresistible?
Yeah.
Like even if we don't want to consciously invoke it, we end up thinking about it. And this has been a topic of some consideration by a number of authors out there. There's one piece in particular that came out in Ian Magazine recently. And this is from, Leela Mee, and the title of the piece is The Seductive Lie of Patient Zero and the Outbreak Narrative. And I just wanted to read a quick quote from it because I thought she really summed it up rather nicely. The allure of Patient Zero rests on the ways in which the figure allows us to assign responsibility and blame when an outbreak occurs. It makes visible the vectors of disease transmission and draws attention to the dangers of human contact, creating distance between the afflicted and the rest of us. When Patient Zero is defined as someone with distinguishing traits of behavior, sexuality, or race, then those of us with differing characteristics can reassure ourselves that we are not at risk. A patient zero lacks both the capacity for self-control and the moral conviction to avoid placing others in danger. The more he or she strays from established norms, the greater the opportunity for reprobation.
Yeah, so basically what she's saying here is when we stray from the status quo, that's when we allow disease to happen, right?
Yeah.
The idea being that patient zeros are culpable, that they're responsible for what they've done. Now, the Dugas legend of him going around and having sex with 250 people and then saying, ha, 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 I gave you AIDS, mm-hmm. plays very well into that. But as we've seen with a lot of these other cases, that's not always accurate.
Right, yeah, and it's... I mean, it comes back around, to this trend throughout human culture to confuse illness with some sort of a moral, disfigurement or any kind of disfigurement, really. Like a physical disfigurement means your soul is twisted in some way, shape, or form, right?
Yeah.
And even no matter how much we try and distance ourselves from that sort of illogical thinking, it has a way of creeping back into our judgment. In the narrative here, this Agent Zero narrative, it gives us someone to blame, often a scapegoat, yeah, an other that makes us feel safer, because we can always say, well, oh, I'm not Asian, or I'm not poor, or I'm not homosexual, I'm not this, that, or the other, whatever makes us feel a little safe. And, you know, I think we all find ourselves engaging in some level of this when dealing with illness, because just the other day, I was talking with my wife about our, you know, illness creeping into our own family.
Mm-hmm.
And, we were saying, well, you know, we eat really healthily. Like how come this is happening to us? And of course that's simplistic thinking on our part, because yes, you know, a healthy diet is important, and that, you know, boosts your immune, system, et cetera. But to think of it as this barrier, as this golden shield against infectious agents that do not work so simplistically.
Yeah.
You know, that, that gets in the way of proper protection and understanding of these illnesses.
Yeah, you also have a four-year-old who's coming into contact with all these other four-year-olds who are wiping, I imagine, their noses or their hands on their mouths or and touching each other and then coming home.
Yeah, you want to talk about incubators for illness. Yeah, any pre-K, kindergarten, first grade scenario is going to be exactly that. But, you know, at the heart of it, though, we want to put a face with a threat, and then we want to reassure ourselves that that face is not our own. And I feel as we experience, something like this, when we even say, look at mugshots, or we want to see the victims of crimes, we want to see what they looked like. We have to know the face of the afflicted or affected individual so that we can evaluate our own standing in relationship to them.
Right. Yeah. And like with all culture, it's basically us trying to figure out how the world works by creating a story that we can understand. Right.
Yeah.
But I think like if you sort of peel the layers away from that story, you see it isn't necessarily always the case with these quote patient zeros. In fact, the term itself is such a misnomer. Really, index case seems to be a more responsible term.
Yeah.
So, you know, as we've just said over the last 2 weeks, Robert and I have been battling off illness. It's that time of year also. I think a lot of stuff's going around. So maybe those of you out there that are listening can relate to this. If you want to get in touch with us and you want to let us know your thoughts on the patient zero narrative or just, you know, in general, how disease is transmissible, you can always hit us up on social media. We are on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and Instagram.
And hey, if you want to, specifically the discussion of AIDS and HIV was of interest to you and you want to learn more, we do recommend checking out the International AIDS Society, or IAS. You can find them at www.iasociety.org. And if you want to send us an email, just simply shoot us your missive at blowthemind@howstuffworks.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
Today's episode is brought to you by Visible. The future of wireless is here, and it's transparent. Switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible. Get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon, just $25 a month, every month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees, no surprises, no, really.
What are you waiting for? Get with the times and switch to Visible at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
This is it. We've got an Amex Platinum Pro on our hands, ladies and gentlemen. We haven't seen anyone relax like this before in the Centurion Lounge. Is he connecting to complimentary Wi-Fi? Oh, my. Look at that. He is. And you will not believe where he's going next. The Amex dedicated card member entrance for the win. Unbelievable.
When you get travel perks with Amex Platinum, you're part of the action. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Terms apply. Learn more at americanexpress.com/withAmex.